Most of you know, I believe, that we're just about to reach the very sacred day of Guru Purnima. On Tuesday, that will be the full moon day of the month of Ashar, which is the day that's dedicated to worship and reverence and remembering the spiritual teachers of all the traditions, all those worthy of extra respect, and of course, particularly if we are fortunate enough to have received the blessings of a great soul, then our own Gurudev. So I wanted to speak today about this Guru Purnima, and the topic is in praise of the Guru. The date that was chosen for this, of course, this is all legendary and speculative, but it's believed to be the birthday of the great sage Vyasa. Yes, this is also called Vyasa Purnima, the full moon of this month. And Vyasa was perhaps partly a historical, partly legendary figure, because if we look at the things he was supposed to have done in the beginning, he was the one who separated the one Veda. There was only one Veda. He separated it into four. So his real name is Vedavyasa, because he's Vedavyasta. He's the one who separated them. So that would be millennium ago. Then he also wrote the Brahma Sutra, the Mahabharata, the Puranas. Almost everything is attributed to this Vyasa. So not exactly a historical figure, but a figure of great reverence within the whole Indian tradition. It's said that his own disciples worshipped him ceremoniously on this day, and that ever since that time, that this became known as the Guru Purnima, when we offer reverence, as I said, to teachers of all different traditions, all different religions, and especially our own Gurudev. So I'd like to say a few words about the significance of the Guru in spiritual life, the very essential role that he or she plays in our spiritual life, the different ways that we can look upon the human Guru, because we know that Sri Ramakrishna was very insistent that we look upon the Guru as more than a simple human being, that we feel some type of connection with our own chosen ideal, that the Guru is a special manifestation. We had a beautiful hymn that Guru is Brahma, Guru is Vishnu, Guru is Shiva, and Guru is the Supreme Brahman. So this is the attitude of reverence that we take. And we recognize that there's a special grace that's working through the Guru, and that the finding of a Guru is also grace. We read at the very beginning of the Vivek Chodamani that one of the very rare things that we have is the association with the great soul. So this comes only as the grace of God. Even Shankaracharya, who is the ultimate jnani, will talk about that as grace, a type of a very special dispensation, divine dispensation that we get. So we recognize that the Guru comes especially for the disciple, for no other reason. There's no selfish motive or anything there. The word itself, Guru, is very interesting. It's related to the same root that we have in Latin also, that gives us the word gravis, gravity, grave, something serious, something heavy, right? Something weighty that way. And to me, it's very significant, because we have two aspects to this concept of gravity. One is that it's actually the power of attraction. We generally think that it's the power, if you let go of something, it'll fall to the ground. But if the thing you're holding is bigger than the ground itself, that will come up to it. So it's not just one thing falling down. Whichever is larger, has greater mass, will exert a greater power of attraction. So this is the power of attraction that these spiritual souls have, that we come within their orbit and we feel ourselves pulled in. So there's a type of magnetic attraction there, where we're being thrown out in spirituality, this centrifugal force. You know, this balance that we have, the planets going around the sun. There has to be the same amount of force pulling it in as this tendency for it to go flying off. And that keeps everything in it. Now, we find that slightly different is that the attractive power in Guru is greater, and it'll pull us closer and closer and closer. And ultimately, we'll see this oneness between the Guru and the Ishta and ourselves, the Satchidananda, and that'll be the reaching the ultimate goal. So this is the role that the Guru plays. In the sense, this sense, he's really a great magnet, a magnetic personality that draws us closer and closer through that spirituality. There's nothing else. And the spirituality always manifests through a personality. And we find that the personality may be completely different from one to another. That there'll be some who are quiet and serene, there'll be some who are very emotional, there'll be some who like to bang and everything. I'll talk a little bit about our Swami Tathagatanandaji today also. So it manifests in all different ways, but it's the same spirituality manifesting and enlightening that personality, bringing sweetness to that personality and bringing that power of attraction. So it's this power of attraction, number one, and the other is this gravitas, this quality of depth, of weight, of substance that we feel in the presence of these great souls, which makes us automatically want to bow down in reverence before them. We recognize that there's some substance to them that we don't find in ordinary people, that comes from many years of spiritual practice and spiritual realization. So this is that other sense of guru, this greatness, this weightiness, this heaviness. But we can also call anyone a guru who is worthy of this great respect. We have this tradition that all teachers, whether it's in the arts, whether it's music, dance, or whatever, they'll always be referred to as the guru. And our elders, the gurujan, we have this expression, that we'll also pay great reverence to them. I found it very interesting in India that many, of course, will make pranam to any of the elders, whether they're relatives, whether anyone who comes. This is old tradition, of course, and all the young children are supposed to do that. When I went for the first time to our Ramakrishna Mission in Rohora, in the school, and one of our monks was there whom I knew very well, so I went, and I hadn't joined yet. So I wasn't a monk, I was just me showing up there, but all of the kids made pranam to me. And I thought, oh my goodness, what are they doing? Do they know that I haven't joined yet or anything? And then the other monk said, no, this is a tradition. Anyone who comes who's older, who's a visitor, who seems to be a respectful person, that they'll do that. So if we like, we can think of this in Guru Purnima as a day when we show our respect to all of our elders, also our seniors. We'll have also different traditions where it's not simply the human form that becomes the guru, the forces of nature. We have our Avadhuta Gita with the 24 different animals and elements of nature. We'll have the story even of Chintamani and Vilva Mangal, where a prostitute herself is looked upon as the guru because she's the one who turns his mind towards spiritual life. So we'll see there's a great range, and we'll also find the concept of the Upaguru, that there'll be many other secondary teachers other than our own Gurudev that can play a very, very instrumental and important role in our lives. And ultimately, Sri Ramakrishna will emphasize that guru is none other than Satchidananda. And this is his Guru Eva Param Brahma, Sakshat Brahma, Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha, that we worship the Guru as the Supreme Brahman and our very own self. And our very own self, the mind itself, becomes the Guru when we progress in spiritual life that way. Now, I want to start with a couple of questions. One is, what is the need for a guru? And the second, how can we recognize a qualified guru? Now, I'm starting with the first question because I don't like it. I think it's a very poor question. I think it gives us an indication that the person who asks that question has no idea what he or she is talking about. When we say, what is the need for something, there's some implicit understanding that it's something unpleasant. Right? If we're sick and somebody says, oh, you have to take a very bitter medicine, we say, is it necessary? Do I have to? Right? Now, if we understand that finding one of these great souls, taking refuge within Guru, is the greatest blessing in life and sweetens our life so much. No one will ever ask that question. What is the need? Suppose somebody says that, no, it's not 100% necessary. You can realize God without it. We'll say, but why will I give it up? Why will I not take advantage of that? Now, there may be some very rare instances. We may say that Sri Ramakrishna really had no guru in the beginning when he had his first realization of Mother Kali. There was one, what was his name? Kedarnath something Bhattacharya who gave him the mantras that he needed to do the Kali Puja. We don't look upon him as the guru. It was simply Sri Ramakrishna's great yearning that time. Ramana Maharshi, sometimes we point to him as someone who didn't need to. We can't compare ourselves to these two souls for one thing. And even Ramana Maharshi, he used to say that Arunachal, the holy mountain, was his guru. But the point is that such benefit is gained from it, and it's so helpful. We always hear the illustration of somebody trying to learn any of the arts. Say someone wants to be a musician. They want to learn how to play sitar or violin, and they try to do it without a teacher. It may be possible, but it'll be so much more difficult, and it'll take so much longer, and there'll be no tradition that it follows. So the benefit is extraordinary. If we think of the other illustration, Sri Ramakrishna talks about a treasure chest that has fallen to the bottom of the ocean, and there'll be a chain connected to it. And we want to find that treasure, and we have no idea where it is. Now, we have two options. We can keep diving at random. It's a big ocean. What are the odds that we'll find it? We can keep diving at random and hope that we get lucky and that we find it. Or we can find somebody who knows where the end of the chain is. And that person can say, here, take hold of the chain. And link by link, all you have to do is follow it link by link by link, and you're assured that you'll reach that treasure. Now, who won't take advantage of that? So it's really not a question of is it necessary, but why would we not want to? And sometimes if we analyze our mind, we find that there's some fear of losing our independence, or some feeling that the guru will ask us to do something we don't want to do. A real guru won't do that. And sometimes there's a little bit of pride. We even see, even at the time of Sri Ramakrishna, that many of the Western educated members of the Brahmo Samaj and others, they didn't like this idea of the guru. Because everyone is equal. Why should we look upon one person as so much superior and do whatever they tell us to do? But it's a real misunderstanding of this very sweet relationship where the guru won't ask us to do anything that's not in our best interest. And we'll also be able to express ourselves. It's not that we can't discuss these things and any problems that we have, anything that we need to be clarified, that we can also do that ourselves. So the guru really is just an ocean of compassion, the Dayasindhu. We have all these different terms for the guru. It's even said that guru will not take his own liberation until all of his disciples are liberated. that the guru will remain holding the door open until all the disciples have gone through, no matter how many births it takes. Whether it's literally true or not, we don't know. But it's just meant to show the perfectly selfless nature of the guru and the tremendous compassion there. The relationship that we form with the guru is a very pure one, because there's no selfishness, there's no worldliness connected with it. The only thing that's expected of us is to follow the teachings of the guru, to show reverence to the guru, to do some type of service, and the guru has no desire from us other than to see us progress in spiritual life. If we proceed in spiritual life without a spiritual teacher, we can also make great progress in spiritual life. This is not meant to say that unless one takes initiation, there's no hope. But there are certain advantages that we have when we receive something, especially mantra, when we receive it through a parampara, through a succession of spiritual teachers. One thing is that if we choose something on our own, which we can do, and many of us spent years in spiritual practice before taking initiation, it wasn't wasted time or anything, we can choose something, mantra to repeat, or at least have our own spiritual ideal, but there's not the same conviction behind it. And very often we find that we try something, we wonder, is this the best spiritual path for me? We may try something else. We may start digging holes in all different places, trying to get water. So we won't have that conviction that, yes, this is something that has a stamp of approval that I should follow for a whole lifetime. And the second thing is that it's not simply the psychological advantage that now I have something that I can hold on to. There's an actual power that comes through the mantra when it's received through someone who has practiced it and also received it himself or herself that way. In our tradition, of course, we take everything back to Sri Ramakrishna himself. That power, tremendous spiritual power that Sri Ramakrishna had, we feel is still living and is still being transferred from guru to disciple through this act of initiation. So this is a tremendous thing, and having this type of faith in the mantra changes everything for us. When we feel disinclined to do our spiritual practice, or feel dry or something, if we have that faith that each time we repeat the mantra, one link is going, we're that much closer to the treasure, then we'll continue. So it's very, very helpful for all of these reasons. So the main function of the guru is to point out what our spiritual path should be. Now, this is another reason why some people hesitate. They say, well, I know better. Now, it may be that we know ourselves quite well, and it may be that we're not the best judges of ourselves, that we may think that we're very highly qualified for the path of knowledge, when actually, if we follow the path of devotion, it'll be more helpful for us in spiritual life. Even such an advanced soul as Swami Abhedananda felt very much drawn to this path of Advaita Vedanta. And Sri Ramakrishna, he wanted to gently soften it with a little devotion that way. It was really only Swamiji that he of course, he wanted Swamiji to be well-rounded, but that he felt could follow the path of Advaita Vedanta exclusively. So even some of the direct disciples, not only Swami Abhedananda, but others also, they implicitly would follow the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna, because they knew that he could read their minds and hearts better than they could. Now, the other thing is that the guru won't propose any spiritual path for us that we will feel is somehow contradictory to our own nature. It may be in the beginning that we're not quite sure, oh, this is the path I should follow, but it should be very quickly that we realize that, yes, this is the best possible thing for me. But this idea that we should simply accept what the Guru says, we shouldn't question anything, we shouldn't challenge anything, is not showing respect to the Guru. We have the example of Swamiji and some of the others that tested him and didn't accept anything without really fully understanding it. And this is the attitude that one should have. This is a really meaning of Shraddha. Shraddha doesn't mean that we give lip service and say, yes, yes, very nice, if we don't believe it and we haven't understood it. So Sri Ramakrishna told Swamiji that don't accept anything I say without testing it, analyze it. Make sure you understand it. And Swamiji always said that. He said, don't believe something because you read it in the books, because somebody tells you. Test it. Find it out for yourself. Find out the truth of it. But the Shraddha means that if somebody says something that we have great regard for and we don't understand it, we don't dismiss it. That we analyze it, we try to understand it, and try to practice it if we can. If after all of that we find that it's not right for us, then that's a different story. But in the beginning, we have to have this openness of mind, this understanding that the Guru will not push anything, force anything on us that's against our basic nature or that is not good for us in the long run. So from this very practical point of view, the Guru gives us mantra and ishta. This is ishta devata, the aspect of God that will be most suitable to us. Sri Ramakrishna always spoke about this idea of ruchi, taste. And we all have differences, ruchi bheda. He talked about that. And this adhikara, powers of digestion, ajam shakti. He talked about these two things very often. The Guru understands these two things, that our spiritual path should be something that we have a taste for. But if we have a taste for it and we can't digest it, it's also not good for us. So the Guru understands that, and the Ishta Devata and the mantra will reflect that, so that if we say, no, I like this other path, and the Guru can say, you like it, but it's not the best for you. You'll learn to like this. This is called the Sattvika Sukha. This is Sattvika happiness that in the beginning, it may even taste like poison to us. And at the end, it tastes like nectar. We have to practice it, that's all. So we find that the two greatest blessings that we get from this relationship with the Guru are Shraddha and Vishwasa. These two terms are very, very important. Sri Ramakrishna talks about this Vishwasa, Vishas. He says that if we have that, we have everything. This conviction, this burning conviction of the truth of something, and the Shraddha, this attitude of reverence and humility. These two things are extremely important. In the beginning, we have to have this humility and this openness, the Shraddha, in order to be able to receive teachings. I've told this story before, I know, of the Zen master who was approached by a student who wanted to get some instructions. And the student came, and the Zen master saw that this young man was full of pride and arrogance, thought he knew everything, still came and said, give me some teachings. Yes, really thinking that he didn't need any to begin with, but give me some teachings. So the Zen master had him sit down and said, let's have a cup of tea first, and he pours the tea into the cup until it's full to the brim, and then he keeps pouring the tea, and it keeps spilling over. And the young man doesn't know what the Guru is doing, and finally he says, what are you doing? How silly is this? You're trying to pour tea into a cup that's full to the brim. And he said, you think that's foolish? It's equally foolish for you to come to me and think that I can give teachings to you when you're filled to the brim with pride and arrogance. So we also have to be an empty vessel to a certain extent. Not that we don't have our own intelligence and understanding, but we have to have that capacity to receive. We have to be open. So we have to have that attitude of humility and reverence and great confidence and faith in the spiritual teacher and the teachings that we receive. And then ultimately this vishwasa, this conviction grows. A little bit of practice and we become convinced that we're on the right path, that these teachings are true. And it comes through seeing the personality and this spiritual progress that Guru himself or herself has made. This is how faith comes. That it's not through reading books. It's not through even our own direct spiritual practice, because most of us are not yet that advanced that we'll have some real experience that will say, yes, now I know the truth. But if someone tells us something and we see that joy that they tell us comes from spiritual realization is shining in their face, and we see the purity of their character, and we see that tremendous love and compassion, then we become convinced, we get some conviction that two things. One, this is what I want. I would like to be able to transform myself into such a person who's full of joy, full of love, that way. And it's possible. We read about it in some old books. We're not quite sure if it's still possible today. If we see someone, it doesn't have to be a God-realized soul. There are many different levels of spiritual greatness that we can say aren't necessarily the result of that very final liberation or enlightenment or something, but represent a very, very high stage in spiritual life, which is all that's necessary. We'll see with the qualifications of the guru. Guru should be a knower of Brahman. We shouldn't take that too literally, that these fully enlightened God-realized souls are a little bit hard to find. But when we find those who are so far above us in terms of spiritual development, that's enough. We don't have to go around like Swamiji did to everyone and said, "Sir, have you seen God?" Yeah, because in the Ramakrishna order, even if they have, they won't say, "Yes, I have." They'll also have that type of humility. So we get this conviction that God can be realized in this very lifetime. This is the ultimate goal of life. This will bring the greatest joy and happiness to us. And this comes as a result of direct perception of these qualities and virtues in the spiritual teacher, in the guru. So this brings us now to the qualifications of the guru. The scriptures mention four. We can come up with any number. This is nothing absolute. But the first is a stainless character. And this is very important because we know that there are many who pass themselves off as great spiritual teachers who don't have that purity of heart, who don't have that stainless character. So this is always the very first qualification. And untouched by desire, especially this desire to have many disciples. Of course, a desire for money is out of the question. Desire for any enjoyment out of the question. But we'll find there are some who still, this pride is there in how many disciples they have and the name that they have and how many YouTubes they're on and all of these different things. So these two things, and the character of the guru is important in a way that it's not important in other fields. If we have a great scientist who doesn't lead a very moral life, he can still be a great scientist. There's no harm. But if we have a spiritual teacher who doesn't lead a moral life, there's a basic elementary contradiction there. It's impossible. Impossible for such a person to pass himself off as a highly evolved spiritual soul if that purity of heart and that absence of desire is not there. So in spiritual life, really it's the character of the guru that does the teaching more than the words. It's that living example, much more intense than anything that comes through the intellect. It really comes through the heart. So this spirituality, they always say, is caught, not taught. It's something that we receive directly, like the light of one lamp lighting another lamp. It's some direct transmission is there. So the spiritual teacher cannot give any teaching that he or her himself does not follow. We have the story of the doctor who was treating a patient, a very poor man who had come from a distant village. He had to walk a long distance. And the doctor examined him and said, you come back tomorrow and I'll give you your prescription. So he walked all the way back. The next day he came the same long distance. And the doctor said, you do this, that, and the other, but make sure that you don't take any gore, any molasses. So he said, okay, then he left. Now the doctor's assistant was watching this whole thing both days. And he said, why didn't you tell him that the very first day? You made this poor man walk all the way back two different times. Why didn't you simply tell him? And he said, that first day I had a big container filled with gore in my office. If I told him, it's bad for you, don't take it, and he saw that I take it, he would have no faith in my words. So this is the same thing within the guru. If the guru tells us that we should lead a certain type of life, we should avoid doing this and that, and we see that the guru is doing the exact opposite, we won't have any faith in his words that way. So we have these first two. This is very pure heart and untouched by desire, and the knowledge of the scriptures. We shouldn't take this to mean any type of scholarly or academic knowledge. It means a deep understanding of the essence of the scriptures, what these higher teachings are. So we can have someone like Swami Adbhutananda, Latu Maharaj, who could barely read and write, virtually impossible for him to even learn the alphabet. Sri Ramakrishna himself knew more of reading and writing than Latu Maharaj. And yet, he had the perfect grasp of the essential teachings of the scriptures. So it's not an academic type of thing, but that much has to be there. So none of the teachings will simply be something conjured up out of one's own mind, that they'll have some scriptural basis to them. And even it can be a very simple type of understanding. If we look at the wonderful teaching that Totopuri gave to Sri Ramakrishna, when he wanted to tell him what the essence of Gita was, he could have gone on for hours and hours. We have scholars that could go years and years and years giving interpretations of Gita. We ourselves, it took us, I think, 18 years to go through it, right? So Totopuri, he did it in one sentence. He said, if you repeat Gita 10 times, what you end up with is the essence of Gita. Tagi becomes tagi. It becomes renunciation. The fourth qualification, and this is what I mentioned before, is that the real guru should be a knower of Brahman. That means a realized soul. The knower of Brahman becomes Brahman. The knower of Brahman is no longer identified in any way with the body and the mind or the senses. This is, as I said, a very rare thing. If we can find someone who has this deep conviction regarding the truth, who is advanced spiritually, who has this pure character, all of the other qualities, that's enough for us. We'll be greatly benefited by such a guru that way. So we don't have to be like Swamiji and go around and ask everyone, sir, have you seen God? Have you seen God? He did that. He went to Devendranath Tagore and others, and they all just kind of, what could they say? Sri Ramakrishna was the only one. He could say, yes, I've seen God. I see God more clearly than I see even you right now. So that was Swamiji and that was Ramakrishna. There, that relationship was something very special. We can't expect to emulate that, the way that relationship went. Swamiji writes, or actually this was something he spoke in a lecture, that these great spiritual teachers and gurus are like the first lamps from which other lamps are lighted. True, the light is in everyone, but in most people it is hidden. The great souls are shining lights from the beginning. Those who come in contact with them have, as it were, their own lamps lighted. By this, the first lamp does not lose anything, yet it communicates its light to other lamps. A million lamps are lighted, but the first lamp goes on shining with undiminished light. The first lamp is the guru, and the lamp that is lighted from it is the disciple. Now, what about the disciple? What should the attitude of the disciple be towards the guru? We've seen that we need this faith, we need this reverence, this shraddha becomes a very important thing, but we need our common sense also. If we look at the attitude that Holy Mother had towards Sri Ramakrishna, that anything spiritual, she followed it implicitly. But other things, how much food to give the disciples and things like that, she said, that's my business, and don't bother about it. So she would say that in spiritual life, follow the teachings of the guru, and other things, use your own common sense. Because one thing that, and this is also a problem, that some people have too much reverence for the guru and too much dependence on the guru, so that it turns out when the guru passes away, their spiritual life is gone. And this is something that in the Ramakrishna tradition, we try to de-emphasize. There's too much of this personality cult. And this is why you'll find that all of the gurus of our tradition will say no, that Sri Ramakrishna is the real guru, that don't put too much importance on the individual who happens to be the conduit for that spirituality that originates with him. So there's a balance. We want to have tremendous reverence for our own Gurudev, but at the same time, not have that dependence and not make that the whole, the beginning and the end of our spiritual life. We see this. We see this a lot in the West, especially. In India, it's understood a little bit more that there'll just be the president and a few vice presidents that they'll give initiation. You may never see them again. You may not have a very close personal relationship. But that happens in this country more because that potential for a very intimate, close relationship where there's personal service and everything is much greater than here. So that it becomes a type of attachment. And it can be a very good attachment, or it can have a little bit of this negative side to it if, in the absence of the guru, we feel that we have nothing to hold on to. Or if it's so strong that we won't look at any other spiritual teacher. And it'll be constantly this competitive type of thing. But my guru says this. And my guru is greater that way. So this is also, you know, something that has to be avoided a little bit. And the disciple himself has to do certain things. We read in Gita three special things. One is showing reverence by bowing down, pranipata. The other is pariprashna, that we should ask questions. It shouldn't be just, I have such reverence for Gurudev, I don't need to get any instruction, ask anything. If any doubts in our mind, if we want some teaching, we have to ask. And then seva, this type of service to the guru. It comes in many, many different forms. It can be personal service. It can be cooking and cleaning and washing, things like that. Generally, they say the greatest service to the guru is following the teachings of the guru. If the guru sees that we're progressing in spiritual life, that we're very serious in spiritual life, this will make the guru happier than anything else. And not that the guru doesn't appreciate personal service. This is also an important part of the spiritual life. But if we do that without doing our spiritual practice, We won't really be bringing that ultimate joy to the guru. If the guru sees that the disciple surpasses him in spirituality, he'll be very happy that way. So this is that perfectly selfless nature of the guru. So Sri Ramakrishna also didn't emphasize the human personality aspect of the spiritual teacher. He always said, look upon the guru as Satchidananda, as the embodiment of knowledge, bliss, and existence, this Brahman itself in human form, as one with the Ishtadevata, with the chosen ideal. So he said, it is Satchidananda that comes to us in the form of the guru. If a person is initiated by a human guru, he will not achieve anything if he regards his guru as a mere man. The guru should be regarded as the direct manifestation of God. Only then can the disciple have faith in the mantra given by the guru. Once a person has faith, he achieves all. This is that vishwas. If we get that faith, conviction, then we have everything. Now, Sri Ramakrishna also says that once the power of this mantra begins to work, once we begin to progress spiritually, the mind itself becomes the guru. That means we can rely on it. Otherwise, the mind can fool us. It can pose as our benefactor when it's trying to drag us down. The mind is a very tricky thing. It's a great rascal. We know, Swamiji says, like a monkey that's drunk and stung by a scorpion and possessed by a ghost. Yeah, the mind is like that. But when it becomes mature, when it becomes ripened, it itself becomes the guru. That means we can trust it. It will guide us because it's really the presence of the divine within shining in a way that's not distorted by the mind. So then we find that can really help us that way. Then this last idea of these upagurus, that we can take the aid and help of any spiritual teacher. And this is also part of the Ramakrishna tradition, partly because in India especially, there are many people who come from some distant place. They'll have to travel a long way to get to one of our main centers. The vice presidents of the order will go once a year to visit these different centers and give initiation, maybe twice in a year in a big center. And those who take initiation may not have the opportunity to see the guru. Even there are some who will just take initiation and never see their guru again. So they're always told, you go to your local center, or you, anyone that, you know, from the same tradition who you have respect for and everything, if you have any problems, you can go and take advice from them. Because what we receive at the time of initiation is the most important thing. I've heard this from our Swamis, that we receive everything at the time of initiation. This is the key. We're given the key at that time. We just have to practice after that. So we look upon all of these great souls as worthy of reverence. We look upon them all of the gurus of our tradition, as representatives of Sri Ramakrishna himself. We try not to make any distinction. Each and every president of the order, and then all of the vice presidents and trustees, we look upon them with great reverence, special reverence that way. One other very nice teaching of Sri Ramakrishna is that if we have reverence for our own teacher, then we'll automatically have reverence for all teachers. He gives the example of the daughter-in-law who, through her love for her own husband, also has great love and respect for all of her in-laws because of that relationship. So Swamiji says, our salutations go to all the past prophets. So this is a day, as Guru Purnima, of reverence for all these teachers. Past prophets whose teachings and lives we have inherited, whatever might have been their race, clime, or creed. Our salutations go to all those godlike men and women who are working to help humanity, whatever may be their birth, color, or race. Our salutations to those who are coming in the future living gods to work unselfishly for our descendants. Now, I mentioned at the beginning the Swami Tathagatanandaji and this idea of the Ubaguru, how we can benefit from the company of any of these great souls. Swami Tathagatanandaji passed away recently. He was the head of the West Side New York Center for many years. He came to this country in 1977. And I met him the very first year that he came. And he always was extremely affectionate and loving towards me. I received his grace, you can say that way. And he came here many times. He loved our center. He loved our devotees. Many of our devotees, who were not his disciples, looked upon him also as a type of guru. Guru would call, get advice from him. He was so soft-hearted and so rough, had such a rough exterior that some people could miss it even. He was really the proverbial diamond in the rough that he even scared people. He would bang and shout and sometimes give you such a slap that you'd be afraid to go near him. He didn't like people to make pranam to him, so sometimes it would be a wrestling match like that. But very loving and very sweet. He was our trustee for all of the years that the center, even though he never came for the meetings or anything that way. But So we offer, of course, our love and reverence to the memory of Swami Tathagatanandaji. They'll have a memorial service for him on August 20th in New York. I don't know if they've announced anything yet, if they have a venue. Do you know, Bonnie? Yeah, they're looking for, a big church that they'll have it in. Many people will come. So we have the advantage of all of these wonderful senior monks of our order and of other traditions that we can turn to. Once our Gurudev passes away and no longer is here in human form, of course we feel that presence sometimes even more. But sometimes we wonder, who do we ask questions of? Any of these wonderful senior monks, nuns of the order, we can turn to them for advice. So this is a very special occasion. We're a couple of days in advance, Tuesday of this Guru Purnima, where we get the opportunity and privilege to offer our respect, our reverence, our love to this spiritual teacher. So let us sit for a few minutes and let us remember this beautiful relationship, this spiritual relationship we have with the Guru.